Hi, I'm Susan Swain, host of C-SPAN's Q&A, where we spend an hour with nonfiction writers and historians who add context to today's news. As a Boston Globe reporter, John Farrell covered Senator Ted Kennedy's political career. Now, following on his biography of Richard Nixon, which was a Pulitzer Prize finalist, Farrell tackles the complicated story of the youngest Kennedy son in Ted Kennedy, A Life. John Farrell joins us this week to discuss the tragedies, failings, and political triumphs in the life of the Massachusetts senator who succumbed to brain cancer in 2009, ending a nearly 47-year career in the United States Senate. Our conversation will begin in just a moment.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
John A. Farrell, your latest biography is Ted Kennedy, A Life. So I'm going to start by asking you to do the opposite of what you just spent 600 pages doing, which is to sum up the man and the politician in a couple of sentences.
He was a U.S. senator who succeeded despite serious flaws and a life filled with, a tormented life filled with tragedy. That's the way I would describe him.
You also write in the book that his life is an optimum lens to examine the liberal cause. Tell me what you're thinking there.
Well, the Kennedys came into office, JFK came into office in 1960 as something of a centrist. He had liberal advisors. His father had worked in FDR's New Deal. So they had roots in the left. But the civil rights movement and then later the other great movements of the 60s, the feminist movement, the anti-war movement, nudged the Kennedys leftward until they became, in part because they adopted the positions, but in part because they became martyrs to the positions, they became symbols of the American left. And then Ted, of course, has more than 40 years in the United States Senate. You can look at his career, the things that he fought for, the things he fought against, and it becomes really almost a perfect chronology of liberalism from FDR's death onward up until the most recent time of hyperpolarization.
Does his brand, his mark of liberalism, exist with the same vibrancy today?
No. I would say that the progressives, the Bernie folk, the Bernie Sanders folks, are probably a little bit more enthusiastic and perhaps extreme than he was, and that the moderates in the party are a little bit more timorous than he was. I think it's hard to say, and I didn't believe this when I started the book, but I think it's accurate to say that the Senate misses this 400-pound elephant or 800-pound elephant in the room. And his staff, and his staff, and his position on four committees. I mean, he was a major force. They were almost like this little island up on Capitol Hill of brilliance and liberal enthusiasm. And I don't see it there anymore.
Does it say more about the Senate as an institution or about the man?
I think it says both. I mean, because of the circumstances, the way that John Kennedy used television. And then, of course, was assassinated in the way that that dominated television at the peak of television and politics. And then Robert was assassinated on television. I think that they just occupied a position that is unique. Social media now has sort of watered down the political impact of television and the rise of cable news as well. But for a while there, they were everything, and the Kennedys, you know, Jack and Bobby, they were first name people like Elvis and Marilyn. So he being missed definitely is a factor. But I think the other factor is that the Senate has changed. In my personal view, is that it goes to the demise of campaign finance. Ted Kennedy reached across the aisle in 1975-76 and reached out to Minority Leader Hugh Scott And they passed a bill that the New York Times on the front page said, get this, will end the influence of special interest money on American politics forever. And of course, it has been diluted by the Supreme Court, by actions of the politicians themselves. And now we're in a position where it's perfectly normal for a U.S. senator to meet the press and say, well, I can't do that because the donors don't want that. And that's a shame.
Of course, this book was not just the product of the last X years. How long ago did you start covering Ted Kennedy?
I started in 1991, and I came down. I was just in time for the Palm Beach scandal, the rape scandal that involved his nephew. And it was in many ways an opportune time to be introduced to the Kennedys, and in other ways it was an inopportune time. There was some rough sledding there in my early relationship with him, but we did develop a give and take. And then I went on to cover the White House and left Congress. But for two or three years, I got a very good up-close view of Ted Kennedy under a lot of pressure, good and bad. And then I was covering the Clinton White House when he started doing some of the miraculous things in the Senate that led to him being called the Lion of the Senate.
How many times would you say you interviewed him over the years?
Sit-down interviews, probably only, you know, 3 to 6. One notorious one in which I was the first Boston Globe reporter told to sit there and ask if he had a drinking problem. That was an amazing interview. I also interviewed him for my books, but since then. But mostly it was like, you know, he was a great source. If you caught him up in the hallway, you know, he would stop and he'd say, well, you know, sometimes it was hard to, you know, he had a way of mumbling, but he would say, well, you know, this thing is not going anywhere because Warner isn't with it. And you know, if you could decipher that, it was golden information. So lots of times in the halls, only probably three to half dozen times. Like we're talking now.
How did he answer the drinking question?
I think he was a little stunned, and he immediately went from, hey, how you doing, to, oh, it's going to be one of those interviews, is it? And it was tense, and he had a line in mind, which was that I'm going to be more attentive to my behavior, and that was the line throughout that summer. If you remember, his nephew was accused of rape in Palm Beach at Easter, and that summer in August and September was the Clarence Thomas Anita Hill hearings. And Ted might as well have had a brown paper bag over his head because he was so exposed on the issue of sexual behavior, sexual harassment, but also just in no place to be making judgments about somebody else's moral standings. And so he was just silent. He sat there doodling sailboats on a piece of paper while Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill made the case for themselves. And I've had the authors of both of the standard works on the Hill-Thomas hearings tell me that if the Ted Kennedy who had been around 3 years earlier and stopped Bob Bork's nomination to the Supreme Court had been there that summer, that Clarence Thomas would not be on the Supreme Court today. But because he was compromised by his personal behavior, his political behavior was limited, and he was the butt of jokes on Tonight Show, Saturday Night Live, and just not in the position to lead the charge.
You did this with your Nixon biography, but as a writer, what are the challenges of taking a big life and encompassing it in one volume?
The challenge, and sort of what has over time become my thing, has been to take these people who are caricatures. Most people today, most young people, probably know, if they know Ted Kennedy, it's the buffoonish mayor from The Simpsons television show. And if most people know Richard Nixon, it was, you know, the guy that when the bank robbers are about to go into the bank, they pull on a rubber mask and everybody laughs in the theater because it's a Nixon mask. So there are caricatures, big personalities, as you say, who filled time, and they tend to polarize their followers. It's you either love Nixon or you hate Nixon. You either love Teddy or you hate Teddy. He's either Teddy Bear, bad Teddy, or he's the Lion of the Senate. And what I do is I try to say, okay, no matter what he is, there's an interesting story as what he became, what he was. And so let's examine the human being. Let's see why he made the choices that he did. What's the backstory of this particular a move by Nixon or by Kennedy. And biography is great because biography tells the story of a human being. It doesn't tell the story as much of a political leader. And where there's black and white, biography looks for gray. And good biography, the biographer is always guided by empathy for his character because it's a fellow human being under stress. So all these things sort of come into play, and those are my goals as I write, you know, not to write a polemic about how great Ted was and the liberal era was, and how the evil conservatives have attacked it over the years, but to recognize that he was a partisan, he was passionate about what he did, and these guys were enemies, and he had to either suffer at their hands or outwit them.
So two more questions about process before we get into his life more extensively. On the cover flap copy, it notes this. The acclaim accorded his previous book helped him garner access to a remarkable range of news sources. What were the most important of those?
His second wife, Vicky Kennedy. I think that I don't think I'm putting words in her mouth, but I think that the only reason that she didn't want the book to be done, she wasn't ready for a biography. She did not grant me access to his letters and diaries and his private papers. But I think that because what I had done in Nixon, it was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, it was an award winner, and it was inescapable that I was serious and that this book was going to come out. And then in the end, she decided to cooperate, and that was probably along with his son Patrick, those two interviews were without doubt the most valuable.
You also had access to some key diaries.
I didn't have access to diaries. I sort of had to dig them out myself. I asked for the diaries because they knew they existed.
Whose
diaries? Ted's. Mm-hmm. Ted Kennedy's diaries. I knew they existed. He had a habit of coming back from Vietnam or a meeting with Ronald Reagan at the White House of talking into a tape recorder, and then somebody would transcribe it, and it would be filed away and in the vaults at the JFK Library up in Boston. And so I knew they were there and asked for them, and I got turned down. I never lost hope that I might see them at some point. But I learned that, for example, when he came back from Vietnam and he spoke into a tape recorder about his impressions, that transcript then was given to his speechwriters to prepare his speech about what he had seen in Vietnam. And they made a copy, or the original went into their file, and their file ended up at the National Archives with the Judiciary Committee files. Don't ask me why. But going through the Judiciary Committee files, file by file by file, all of a sudden, here in the speech writing file, is Ted Kennedy's diary entries from Vietnam. So I knew they were there from that point on, and I was like this from that point on, looking for more diary entries scattered throughout his papers, and eventually came away with a pretty, you know, for an unauthorized sampling, it turned out to be a pretty good sampling.
You also cite and some really insightful comments from historian Arthur Schlesinger.
Yes, Arthur Schlesinger's journal is a great book, and that was published when he died, probably a little bit more than a decade ago. But it's 6,000 pages long, and so when I was doing the Nixon biography, I discovered that there was lots of interesting stuff in the 5,500 pages that hadn't made the published version, including some very interesting material about Ted Kennedy. So it's been probably 10 years that I've known this material was there, 10 years in which I was just hoping every day that I wouldn't read about it in another news organization or in somebody else's book. But fortunately, nobody wanted to go to the New York Public Library and go through 6,000 or 5,500 pages. And what happened was after the accident at Chappaquiddick, where Mary Jo Kopechne, an aide to Robert Kennedy, was killed in Ted Kennedy's car, Arthur Schlesinger, who was a friend and confidant to the Kennedy family, went to Hyannisport, and he talked to Gene Kennedy Smith, Steve Smith, and to the senator himself and to Ethel Kennedy about the events at Chappaquiddick. And so for the first time out of the lion's mouth, you have a version of, you know, here's what happened, here's what he told his family. It's not a great revelation that Ted Kennedy tried to small c cover up the accident, tried to escape responsibility for the accident. It is, I think, one little brick in the wall of history that he admitted it to his sister, and the word came to Schlesinger, and it's in Schlesinger's a prominent historian's diary, so it's pretty much as solid as you're going to have. So that was my little piece of the jigsaw puzzle.
So I want to get to his adult life, but you spend a good bit of time on his family life growing up. What are the most, I think, important influences from his childhood that helped influence the man that Ted Kennedy would become?
Family. Good family, bad family, but always family. It was an immensely wealthy family. And they had benefits that few other people had. On the other hand, the father traveled often and was a philanderer. And the mother, in reacting to that, became very cold with the kids. And by the time the ninth came along, Ted was shipped out to his first boarding school at the age of seven. So he had not just the wonderful summers with his brothers and sisters at Hyannisport playing touch football and all the, everything that we know about from the Kennedy myth. He also had aching loneliness in one of the schools. There was some degree of sexual molestation by a hall proctor. It was a Dickensian childhood in some ways. And he gave a short story that he wrote when he was a little kid to a professor at the University of Virginia, and the University of Virginia professor recounted it in an oral history, and the short story was that it was about a little boy who was very, very lonely at school and decided that he would run away, and as he was running away, his suitcase opened up and all his belongings fell out and fell down the hill, and they caught him and they brought him back, and it's a very sad tale to have written as a schoolboy when you're asked to write a short story, and it sort of captures, I think, what that was like. He idolized his older brothers, and he always thought that he was not in their league. And he always thought...
What did they think of him?
They sort of added to that. I mean, part of the reason that he felt that way was that they were incessant teases, and they thought he was... John Kennedy called him a gay illiterate. Not gay as we know it now, but sort of a happy-go-lucky illiterate, and in no way was Ted Kennedy ever prepared for anything that happened to him after the age of 32, and never expected to be to wear the crown. He was the jester of the family, not the prince.
I think this was a JFK quote that you had, which said, "Life as a son of Joe Kennedy Sr. had made you doomed to a treadmill."
Yes. Joe had decided in the 1930s that with all the money he had made, he still didn't have the power that he craved, that he would have to find that power in the time of the Depression, the way Roosevelt did, through politics. And he screwed up his own political career by being accused fairly of appeasement in the years right before World War II. And so he had to pass his ambitions on to his sons. And all of his sons felt, as John F. Kennedy said, "Pappy's eyes on the back of my neck." And when Joe Jr. Died in war, John Kennedy moved up, and Robert Kennedy moved up as confidant to John. And when John Kennedy was killed, Robert Kennedy, I mean, it's really striking. Robert Kennedy takes John's seat in the family airplane and begins to wear the bomber jacket that the president always wore. It's primogeniture, like something out of the feudal ages. And then Robert is killed, and the last kid, the kid that was never supposed to inherit all this, now becomes the inheritor of this legacy. And by this time, we talked about television, by this time this legacy is Camelot. And liberals all over America are just worshipful of Kennedy, and he has to cope with it. And between the time that Robert Kennedy died in June of 1968 and the accident in Chappaquiddick in July of 69, it's striking how many people said, "He's heading for a crack-up. Look at this behavior. This behavior is frantic. He's drinking too much. He's driving too fast. And something bad is going to happen." And of course, then it did.
He married at the age of 22. You said one of the family codes that marriage vows are elastic. Now, she was 22, and he was 26 at the time they got married. What should people know about that marriage?
It's sad, as much of the book is. Joan Bennett Kennedy was a lovely young woman, went to a Catholic girls' college in outside New York, Manhattanville College, where she was a student with Jean Kennedy Smith, who introduced her to this hulking, amazingly gorgeous guy named Ted Kennedy. And again, nobody at that point knew that she was going to have to be anything more than, at the most, a senator's wife. Nobody ever coped with the idea that she would be sucked into this maelstrom, this series of immense tragedies. And they had one probably happy good year in Washington. He was elected in November of 62, and they moved down here, and so they had one year of the new frontier before JFK was assassinated. And from that point on, the stresses in their life led to her drinking problem, which was accelerated by his philandering, it was a marriage that Jean Kennedy Smith once said was like a Eugene O'Neill play, A Long Day's Journey Into Night, tragic in almost every way.
The union produced three children. How were they impacted by their parents' problems?
I think they were all impacted. If you read their oral histories or talk to them, they put up a brave front. They say, you know, Dad tried to give us much time, given the time constraints that he had, and we have warm memories of skating on the canal or playing hockey or going sledding, and he would have like people like Henry Kissinger over for dinner, and he would seat his kids at the dinner table so they could see what Dad did. I mean, he tried very hard to keep them in his life. But all three of them, any one of these tragedies would have dominated your life and my life. And as bad as they are, they're almost parenthetical to some of the others. All three of his kids had cancer before middle age. All three developed substance abuse problems. I mean, any one of those things would, you know, command your and my attention. Oh my God, my kid's got cancer. Oh my God, my second kid has cancer. My third kid has cancer, right? So this is a guy that faces that at the same time that his brothers are being killed, that he's being exposed in public. He's got three members of the family die in plane accidents. I mean, it's why the story is, I said Dickensian before, but it's actually Shakespearean, and it's why everybody is still fascinated with it today.
Ran for the Senate first at the age of 30, the legal age for joining the Senate. Was it something he wanted, or was it a family decision?
It was something he wanted, but it was also a family decision. He helped Jack in the 1960 campaign, and there was a moment there when he and Joan considered leaving the fold, getting out to Arizona or Colorado or New Mexico and forging a life of their own in a Western state, in politics, but doing it on their own. And instead, his dad said, the shorthand that's come down over history, I've never been able to find him actually saying it, is, you know, we paid for this seat and we're not going to give it up. Robert was going to become Jack's attorney general, so that left somebody. But Teddy was 2 years too young, and so they had this long, convoluted thing where they had to pressure the governor to appoint somebody who was tame enough and agree to leave the seat 2 years so that Ted could run, and he was installed as U.S. Senator. It was amazing as a U.S. Senator. It was an amazing race nonetheless, because Eddie McCormick, who was the nephew of the Speaker of the House, John McCormick, ran in the primary against them, and so it became Teddy versus Eddie. And it was an astonishing moment in American history. And everybody at that time wrote about it, the Post, the Times, Life magazine. It was more than just a local race. It was totemic.
I wanted to get this description of the Senate just on the record because it's so colorful. You write of the Senate in 1963 when he arrived. It was then a sump of aged men with liver spots, claws, and bourbon breath, who strode the chamber with reptilian gait and hailed one another with mellifluent courtesies.
Well, I probably should nod to Robert Caro and Hunter Thompson there.
A very different Senate than today?
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, the Everett Dirksen, for example, was the Republican leader. The 64 Civil Rights Act would not have passed without Everett Dirksen. The Voting Rights Act of 65 would not have passed without Everett Dirksen. The Immigration Act of 1965 would not have passed without Everett Dirksen. He worked hand in hand with Lyndon Johnson in the White House on all these things. I mean, they were a generation that had come together and fought World War II. And as they left World War II, they had two things in mind. One is that government can do amazing, good, big things. You know, Dwight Eisenhower, a conservative, let's build the interstate highway system. You know, I mean, today it would be, oh my God, what an abuse of federal power and impact on the taxpayer. But in that golden era, this generation said, yeah, that's a good idea. Let's do that. John Kennedy, let's go to the moon. Again, that generation, yeah, we can do that. And because they had been in foxholes together, and because they faced this existential threat of being under the gun of Soviet nuclear missiles, they were together in a way that you can't imagine looking back today. They weren't all heroes. They had to be, all of them, including the Kennedys, had to be dragged by their collars, kicking and screaming, to pass that, to address civil rights and pass that Civil Rights Act, for example. And they got us into Vietnam out of arrogance and hubris. But it was an amazing moment in American history for these guys who came home and decided, you know, we can do big things. And that feeling of national unity and ambition is totally lacking today, and that's a great shame.
Where was freshman Senator Ted Kennedy on November 23rd, 1963?
He was sitting, because he was a freshman, he got the duty of sitting in the Senate, presiding over the Senate. And so he was sitting there listening to somebody droning on probably about postal reform or some issue like that. And all of a sudden, up there in the dais, and all of a sudden, an aide came in and went over to the minority leader and went over to the majority leader or whoever was controlling the floor leader. And then he came up to the dais and he said, Senator, your brother, the president, he's been shot. And immediately he left, and by the time he got back to his office, the news was on the radio and his staff was shocked, and the telephone lines were totally jammed all over Washington, and it took him probably half an hour. He finally decided to go home. He gets home and he finds out that Joan is at the hairdresser, and his kids are over at the White House for a play date. And so he's all alone. His phone's not working. He goes knocking on doors in Georgetown, finally finds a phone, gets through to Robert Kennedy, and Robert Kennedy's first words to him is he's dead, and you're going to have to call our mother and our sisters. And that was his duty for the weekend, was taking care of the family while Jackie and Robert took care of the country.
I'm going to fast forward to the 1964 election when Robert Kennedy was elected to the Senate. First time you note that two brothers had been in the Senate since the 1880s. They had 3.3 years together before Robert Kennedy lost his life. How did they use that time?
Well, there was never any doubt of two things. One, that Robert was the senior, even though he was the junior senator. And two, that Teddy was better at the job than Robert was. Robert at that time was in John Kennedy used to, when he was alive, used to call him Black Robert because he was such a serious, sometimes mean guy. But he was now in this amazing place of toughness and determination, and yet a gentleness that had been awakened by the suffering that he went through after his brother died. Ted was asked to shoulder all the gruesome duties of, like, dealing with the Warren Commission, because it was happy go lucky Ted. And everybody assumed that that he was dealing with this well, and basically what he was doing, he was burying his own grief. And then Robert decides that to fill Phil's legacy, he has to challenge Lyndon Johnson over Vietnam in 68. And Ted, being much more the legislator, the member of the Senate club, says, don't do it. You can walk into the White House in 72. And Robert says, no, I insist, I got to go do it. And Ted says, okay. Dutiful younger brother says, okay, then I'm with you, and goes out and does a masterful job running the Indiana primary for him.
And then in June of 1968, Robert Kennedy assassinated by Sirhan Sirhan. Ted Kennedy was how old at that point?
Yeah, I didn't know this. One of these how old questions can happen. He was born in 32, so what does that make him? 36?
36 years old. We have a video, the first one I want to show, from him delivering the eulogy for his brother. Let's watch that.
My brother need not be idealized or enlarged in death beyond what he was in life. To be remembered simply as a good and decent man who saw wrong and tried to right it, saw suffering and tried to heal it, saw war and tried to stop it. Those of us who loved him and who take him to his rest today pray that what he was to us, what he wished for others, will someday come to pass for all the world. As he said many times in many parts of this nation, to those he touched and who sought to touch him, some men see things as they are and say why. I dream things that never were and say, why not?
You report in the book that son Patrick said the toll was even greater on his father from Robert's death than it had been on John's. Explain.
Yeah. Patrick has left politics and gone on to be an advocate for mental health issues. And so he knows post-traumatic stress disorder and other issues like other maladies like that. And he says that the constant referral to the two deaths, the movies, the documentaries on television. Ted Kennedy couldn't sit down and watch television. All of a sudden, there'd be a clip of some argument over the Warren Commission, and there would be the motorcade in Dallas, again, or there would be the chaos in the kitchen at the Ambassador Hotel in 1968 when Robert was killed. And so it was inescapable. It was always there, and yet among the Kennedys, and especially among the Kennedys' men, the idea that you would undergo some sort of just recognition of what it was doing to you, or much less counseling, was taboo, just not part of the family code.
You made reference to this earlier in our conversation, but Ted Kennedy himself described the period after 1968 as the time of the greatest questions. So how did he start assuaging his grief?
One thing he lost was his faith for a while. The Kennedys are interesting because on one hand, you have one of John Kennedy's friends once asked him, how do you rectify, how you treat your wife with, this religion? Why do you keep doing things like say your prayers at night and, obey, go to church? And JFK said, very practical. If you don't want to lose total touch, because if you lose total touch and then something awful happens, then you've lost the consoling power of religion. So you don't want to put yourself, in that particular spot. And by the time that John and Robert and Joe Jr. had all and Kathleen Kick had all died in violent deaths, Ted Kennedy lost that faith. And it was not until the very end of his life that he seemed to regain it. It became important to him again. He said, "My counseling was the walking beaches and getting out in a sailboat and battling the waves."
But this was also a time of fast cars, women, and lots of alcohol.
Yep. no two ways about it.
Why did the press not report it?
Well, that's... eventually they did. Even at the time of Chappaquiddick, there begin to be like hints in Time magazine about the senator's eye for a comely lass or something like that. I mean, very gentle. But it wasn't really until I think Chappaquiddick and Watergate were the two big shocking events for the press that said, you know, the old days of, you know, covering up for, you know, boys will be boys are ended. We have to examine character before we put somebody in the White House like Nixon. And we have to address Ted Kennedy's flaws because, my God, look what happened. It cost a young woman her life.
So on Chappaquiddick, we have an ABC News report that includes Ted Kennedy's statement about the accident, July 25th, 1969. Let's listen to what he had to say.
The car overturned in a deep pond and immediately filled with water. I remember thinking as the cold water rushed in around my head that I was for certain drowning. Then water entered my lungs and I actually felt the sensation of drowning. But somehow I struggled to the surface alive. I made immediate and repeated efforts to save Mary Jo by diving into the strong and murky current, but succeeded only in increasing my state of utter exhaustion and alarm. This last week has been an agonizing one for me and for the members of my family. And the grief we feel over the loss of a wonderful friend will remain with us the rest of our lives.
You explained earlier that extra brick you brought to the story, but I guess the question I wanted to ask, so how many hours were between him making repeated attempts to save Mary Jo and his reporting to the police?
10 hours.
And
it's craven. It was absolutely craven. That whole time, as he went back to Edgartown and ostentatiously appeared in the lobby of his hotel asking what time it was, dry and fully dressed, to establish an alibi. She was still in that car and still in that pond. And when his cousin and another aide found him the following morning, he was having breakfast with fellow sailors from the regatta. And they said, "Have you reported it?" And he said, no, I'm going to tell, we're going with the story that Mary Jo was driving the car." And they pulled him into a room and they said, you can't do that. Still, they did not go to the police. They went to a phone so that he could call and talk to other advisors. And while they were doing that, they saw the ambulance/hearse go over on the little ferry to Chappaquiddick, and they realized that they had about 15 minutes to get to the police and make some kind of report, which in its own way was candid. It said, I was the driver of that car. He never tried to justify it. He called it inexcusable. He said that he panicked. The awful part, looking back, the awful part for a biographer is to realize that, boy, you know, this was a crude attempt to stay out of jail and establish an alibi.
If his name were not Kennedy, would he have been charged?
If his name was not Kennedy, he probably would have gone right to a house and called the police or stopped at the fire station on the way back to the cottage and called in. But if you or I had been in an accident like that and there was no proof of reckless driving or drinking, then what he finally was convicted of, which was leaving the scene of an accident, he was sentenced to 2 months in jail, suspended. And the Boston Globe, the vaunted Boston Globe spotlight team, examined all the records and said, yeah, for a young person with a clear record, that's, you know, probably the sentence that you or I would have gotten.
But of course, 10 hours later, the alcohol would have been gone from his system.
And even Arthur Schlesinger immediately in his diary writes, you know, it just leaps out at us. Yeah.
So how did it impact his political effectiveness? Watergate was a few years really after that, and he was possibly going to be tasked with the Watergate investigation. So how did that play out?
Well, before he got there, I mean, it's unbelievable. He was still the presidential front runner. And one of the pictures I love in the book is that when he campaigns in 1970, after Chappaquiddick, there's this picture of these nuns standing on the side of the road holding a big banner that says, "We love our Ted." And the news coverage of him marching in the St. Patrick's Day parade, it's like, you know, it's like the Mardi Gras with him as the king of the parade. So it was astonishing how durable the Kennedy myth was at that moment. This was before Watergate and before the church committee revealed a lot of the sins of John and Robert, that he was still a front runner that really scared Richard Nixon and helped prompt some of the dirty tricks that emerged as Watergate. But to get back to your question, in August and September of that year, his staff uncovers a key witness to the Watergate scandal. And rather than hold a big public hearing with television cameras, they leave it to poor Woodward and Bernstein to go knocking at doors at night and put the story together, because they were afraid, A, that it would be seen as political hatchet work, Kennedy versus Nixon, but B, you know, their guy just did not have the moral authority to hold those kind of hearings, and they knew that he would be vulnerable on Chappaquiddick and what Teddy told Carl Bernstein, you know, a lot of nickel and dime stuff, which meant other drinking and women episodes.
And once again, in 1976, the family, with his blessing, prepped for a presidential run, which he ultimately decided not to make. Your assessment in the book that of the 20 years that he considered the presidential process, 76 was probably his best bet. Why so?
I think because it was after Watergate, which perversely would come to work against him. But the Republicans were deeply wounded. There was a huge Democratic majority. Gerald Ford had inherited inflation and unemployment from Jimmy Carter, so a Democrat was going to win. And the field that year ended up being swept by this unknown, out-of-work, one-term governor from Georgia. It's hard not to think that had Kennedy wanted to run, that he could not have gotten the nomination, and again, I think almost any Democrat would have been elected president. As it was, Carter just barely beat Gerald Ford.
You write about the rivalry between the Kennedy and the Carter camps, describing it as a turning point in American politics and government that changed the course of American liberalism.
Not just American liberalism, but I think American politics. That Jimmy Carter, when I interviewed him, said that there were three reasons he lost. One was inflation, two was the Iranians seized the embassy in Tehran, and the third was the Kennedy challenge in the primaries, which went on and on and on, and was fueled by personal hatreds and rivalries, both at the top between the two of them, but also among their staffs. And that led, I'm not going to say that it wouldn't have happened anyway, but that certainly contributed to Ronald Reagan ushering in a new conservative era. And hats off to Reagan. Once he got elected, he showed us what a great president could do in terms of unifying people and moving the public. And even though it was in a direction opposite of Ted Kennedy's, Kennedy always admired Reagan for restoring grace and power to the presidency, which was a way of saying that Jimmy Carter had let it ebb away.
We only have 15 minutes left and so much to cover, so I'm going to fast forward through this. But the 1980 campaign was the time of that famous interview on CBS with Roger Mudd, where he seemed to hesitate on even explaining why he wanted to run for presidency. A lot of people speculate it was a self-sabotage moment, that he really didn't want it. It was fulfilling
Absolutely.
The family destiny. You have a different analysis.
No, I believe that. I believe that he was...
I thought you wrote that he did want the presidency.
He did want the presidency. I mean, he wanted to... He felt that he had to run because of the legacy. And the U.S. senators were coming to him, and they were saying, "Oh God, Ted, you got to save the party. It's a slam dunk. You'll beat this guy." And Jerry Brown, the governor of California, was already challenging Carter, so there was like, no, this was a set thing. I think he certainly would have wanted to exercise the powers of the presidency for the things that he believed in, and he certainly would have wanted to whip Jimmy Carter. But psychologically, subconsciously, it's a very likely explanation to what happened in the Mudd interview was that it was self-sabotage, as you said. I mean, he didn't believe he was as good as his brothers. He had doubts about his ability. And that year, whenever he got close to the White House, he created obstacles for himself, and he performed the best when he was furthest away. So his best moment of that entire campaign is when he's lost and he addresses the crowd in Madison Square Garden and says, "The dream shall never die." And his worst moment was the Roger Mudd interview, when everybody said, "Oh my God, Kennedy is an odds-on favorite to be the next president of the United States."
So Ted Kennedy focused on the Senate for the next couple of decades, and it was perhaps his period of most fruitful legislation, the 80s and the 90s, a lot of cooperation with Republicans on major legislation. I'm going to show one of those. This is from 1990 on the Ryan White AIDS Act. Let's take a look.
"Dear Senator, my son Ryan White spent the last 5 years of his life not only fighting for his life, but also fighting for the lives of all people living with AIDS. This bill will help ensure that all people with AIDS and HIV infection receive the health care they need and they deserve. One thing that was extraordinary, many things about this remarkable young man, but after he received that tainted blood transfusion, to the moment he drew his last breath here on earth, he never condemned anyone. He wasn't looking for the scapegoats."
Reaction?
It was an amazing moment. If you had, we've seen what happened with the pandemic, 2 years ago. But at that time, this was a disease that struck the pariahs in society: intravenous drug users, Haitian refugees, and the homosexual community. And no politician wanted to be part of it. And the opposing view was voiced by Jesse Helms of North Carolina, a staunch conservative who wanted to make sure that nobody in the country, not just gay Americans, but that nobody had sex or sexual pleasure outside of a marriage. And so Ted Kennedy, forging one of his great partnerships with Orrin Hatch, Republican from Utah, and with Bob Dole, Republican leader, educated the Senate, devised a strategy, and pushed these bills through to provide a real federal response for the AIDS crisis for the first time. It's, Richard Nixon and the war on cancer, Ronald Reagan, extension of the Voting Rights Act for 25 years, Bob Dole, AIDS and voting rights, Hugh Scott, campaign finance, Everett Dirksen, civil rights, Howard Baker, one man, one vote, Lindsey Graham and John McCain, immigration. I mean, you can't pick an issue. Nancy Kassebaum and Ted Kennedy and education. George W. Bush and Ted Kennedy, education. You can't pick a domestic issue from that time period in which Ted Kennedy's ability to forge an alliance with a Republican president or a leading Republican senator was not a key factor. I mean, there's the House of Representatives, there's the White House, there's other committees in the Senate, but the key so often in many of these debates is Kennedy's ability to, you know, with John Danforth and Bob Dole in the Disabilities Act. I mean, just time after time after time, he forges these bipartisan alliances. And I think it was Thomas Jefferson who said that that great measures have to be passed with all factions in support. And Jefferson said it better than I just did. But and I think that that was a guiding light of Ted Kennedy throughout his career.
I would like to speak about another area with his seat on the Judiciary Committee, his influence on the shape of the modern Supreme Court. We do have a clip on this. This is only 33 seconds, where it really started with the Robert Bork nomination in 87.
Robert Bork's America is a land in which women would be forced into back alley abortions, blacks would sit at segregated lunch counters, rogue police could break down citizens' doors in midnight raids, and school children could not be taught about evolution. Writers and artists would be censured at the whim of government. And the doors of the federal courts would be shut on the fingers of millions of citizens for whom the judiciary is and is often the only protector of the individual rights that are the heart of our democracy.
So many people who are court watchers point to the Bork nomination as the pivot point when Supreme Court nominations became very partisan from that point forward. Ted Kennedy led the charge. Is he responsible for the direction?
Absolutely not. They're wrong. It started in 1968 when Richard Nixon was running for president and Lyndon Johnson was trying to maneuver to get Abe Fortas as Chief Justice, and the Republicans filibustered and attacked Abe Fortas on character issues, which then got the Democrats to use character issues against Republican nominees Haynesworth and Carswell. So this goes back in our history to the 60s. What he was actually doing there, it's interesting, was not so much attacking Bork to cow his Republican opponents, but he wanted to put backbone among, this was the Reagan years, Reagan was highly popular, he wanted to instill some backbone among Democratic moderates, especially those from the South. And so what he was saying, he rushed to the floor to make this speech, and what he was saying was, hold your fire, I'm gonna be launching a full-scale attack on this, and before you go home to Mississippi or Louisiana and say to the mainstream that who love Ronald Reagan that I'm going to vote for that nominee, you got to consider that that your black constituents and your white liberal constituents, the people that put you in office in those states, have just been told who this guy is and that I'm going to lead a crusade against him. And it worked. Joe Biden had always liked to think of himself as a moderate and a thoughtful a scholar of the court, and had told the newspapers that Bork would not be necessarily a bad choice. And part of what Kennedy was doing there was freezing Biden, who was running for president. And sure enough, before the summer was over, Biden had joined him in the campaign against Bork.
So 6 minutes left. I'm going to fast forward to the last year of his life. I feel like we're doing this on fast motion. We can do that. So he was diagnosed with his brain tumor when?
That would have been, it was right after, it was the election year.
So May 2008.
2008, yeah. Yeah. Obama was running, and he had just endorsed Obama.
Yeah, which the Clintons reacted how to that endorsement?
Not very well. It was an interesting endorsement because everybody expected that Teddy would endorse Hillary. Bill Clinton and Ted had worked together on Northern Ireland, many other things, so that was a shock. But he was convinced that we needed to make a leap, and he saw in Barack Obama a generational change, generational star that could make that leap.
After his diagnosis, he did go to the 2008 Democratic National Convention to speak in favor of the nomination. This will be the last clip we show. It's about 40 seconds long.
As I look ahead, I am strengthened by family and friendship. So many of you have been with me in the happiest days and the hardest days. Together, we have known success and seen setbacks, victory and defeat. But we have never lost our belief that we are all called to a better country and a newer world. And I pledge to you that I will be there next January on the floor of the United States Senate when we begin the great count.
How ill was he at that time?
It's an incredible clip because, first of all, he's loaded up with painkillers because on the plane on the way out to Denver, he had intense pain. They didn't know what it was. He said, they took me to the hospital and I was examined by every ologist that they had. It turned out to be painful kidney stones. And so he was sedated, and then they gave him morphine or some very strong painkilling drug. And because he had the brain tumor, there were certain words and phrases that he had difficulty pronouncing. So his speechwriter, Bob Shrum, had written a speech of about twice as long as what he eventually gave that they had rehearsed over and over again because he was so afraid of falling on his face and stumbling and because of the illness. And they realized that he couldn't give that speech. And so they cut it in half, and he had to go out there and give, worst case scenario was he had to go out there and give a speech that he had not practiced. That he managed to pull it off as well as he did is astonishing. It's a great indication of that quality of perseverance that he had and resilience that he had all through his life that gave a voice to the Lion of the Senate nomiker.
Throughout the book, you tell that the issue of his career was health care, and he didn't live long enough to see the Affordable Care Act signed into law, but he spent his last months working on it. How so?
Well, first of all, there's some sort of question as to exactly how firm a deal it was, but there was certainly an understanding between he and Obama that Obama would push health care and in return for the endorsement. And then Kennedy went to work in committee drafting the bill with all the stakeholders and senators from the Democratic and at that point from the Republican side.
While seriously ill.
And then at one key moment, Obama describes them waiting to go out into the East Room in the White House and address a crowd together. And Teddy taking him by the hand and saying, "Mr. President, now is the time. Don't miss this moment." And, look, I'm not going to pretend that Nancy Pelosi and Barack Obama are anything other than, or Harry Reid, really tough politicians with hides of rhinoceros. Throughout all that thing, as he died and after his death, "Let's do this for Teddy" was part of the calculus. And he was so much a politician that even after he died, he left a letter to Obama, to be delivered after his death, which said to Obama, again, "Don't waste this moment, Mr. President." And Obama, when he speaks to the Congress and the country about the Affordable Care Act, reads from this letter. So that was the spiritual, wonderful part. At the same point, he was maneuvering to make sure that that a Democrat was appointed to his seat in Massachusetts so that they wouldn't lose the majority in the Senate to impose cloture and override a filibuster. So he was constantly, as best he could, as he was losing it those last few months, still taking what steps that he was able to get that through. And Obama, in a very nice part of his own memoir, says that after the celebrations were over, he went back up to the residence in the White House, and he thought of two things. He thought of his mother, who had died of breast cancer, and he thought of Ted Kennedy.
Well, there was lots more in that 77 years that we couldn't get to in this hour together, but thank you very much for spending it with us. The book is Ted Kennedy, A Life. John A. Farrell, the author, thanks for being with us.
I like telling this story, as you probably can tell. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to C-SPAN's Q&A, and subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts so you'll never miss an episode. And while you're there, please take a minute to rate and review us. You can also send us an email about Q&A at podcasts@c-span.org. Send me your questions, your comments, or ideas. Your feedback is welcome.